Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 31st of May, these are our main stories. Crowds of demonstrators have been gathering again in US cities as the authorities step up their efforts to prevent further violence over the death of a black man in police custody. The first US astronauts to be sent into space by a private company have successfully lifted off from Florida, and the number of coronavirus cases recorded around the world has just passed 6 million. Also in this podcast. I just wanna live. We'll find out how the emotions of the events in Minneapolis have been summed up by a song from a 12-year-old soul singer, Kedron Bryant. As we record this podcast, crowds of protesters have again been gathering in American cities after several nights of violent demonstrations over the killing by police of an unarmed black man. In Minnesota, where George Floyd died, the state's entire National Guard is being mobilized to try to prevent further trouble. The governor, Tim Walz, said rioters had caused wanton destruction and chaos. The attorney general, William Barr, promised justice would be served in that case, but he said the violence that has spread to cities across the country was unacceptable.
Unfortunately, with the rioting that is occurring in many of our cities around the country, the voices of peaceful protest are being hijacked by violent radical elements. Groups of outside radicals and agitators are exploiting the situation to pursue their own separate and violent agenda.
Our correspondent Barbara Plettacher is in Minneapolis.
I have seen quite a lot of burned out and wrecked buildings, an extraordinary number, actually. A lot of small businesses have been completely gutted. I'm standing next to a chicken restaurant, looking through the broken, gaping windows. There's some water spouting out in the middle of it, and you can still see smoke coming up. And that's the kind of scene you see in different parts of the city. And people here are kind of perplexed about the level of the violence and destruction. You know, when it comes to unrest, that dealing with police and how they treat black men and women, Minneapolis has seen it before, but the governor himself was saying this seems to be at a new level, and he is blaming outsiders for it. He has said that this is not really about George Floyd, it's about something else. But whatever the case, he's calling up the full force of the National Guard to deal with it. There are many people who have been protesting peacefully, and some of them, in fact, many of them, I'd say a small army of them, were just in this area where I am now, also coming out with buckets and brooms to clean up. They were just basically cleaning up all the mess, and that was quite interesting to see. But I think there is a wariness and an uneasiness about tonight because there's an expectation that the violence will return.
That was Barbara Plettacher in Minneapolis. Julian Marshall spoke to Mike Griffin, a long-standing community organizer in Minnesota.
The situation in Minneapolis is about getting justice for George, but it's also about the systemic racial and economic disparities that we have in the state for the past decades. This is about us having big progressive policies to actually shrink the racial disparities we've been seeing in this country and in the state, and specifically in the city. So while it is great that the officer has been charged, that's just a first step in a very long battle. We would like all the four officers to be charged that were there. We would like them to be convicted. But more importantly, the reason that we're in this situation right now with Minneapolis burning is because of years of systemic issues with the police department and years of issues with racial and economic injustices in the state and country.
What do you make of the governor's decision to employ Minnesota's National Guard?
We can do as much National Guard and curfews as we want. The governor and the mayor have the power to actually do things that's going to have policy changes, that's going to affect lives of people who are protesting. They have the power to actually implement policies to make my life better, to make my life seem like it matters. I will continue to protest. I will continue to organize until we shrink these racial disparities, until we end white supremacy, until I take my last breath. I will continue to protest and organize in this country. And so what the governor can do and what the mayor can do is that their lane is to create policies that's going to stop this from jump. Meaning he had a whole press conference yesterday where he was like, he's calling out that the racial issues are systemic in this state, and knowing that the anger is there. And like, that's the first step, acknowledging the fact that this is a big systemic problem. Thank you for acknowledging that.
Minnesota community activist Mike Griffin. Julian Marshall also spoke to Philippe Cunningham, a member of Minneapolis City Council for the ruling Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. He had just finished an emergency meeting, the first since George Floyd's death.
We right now are going to be decisions around ratifying the local emergency declaration, as well as beginning conversations around what next steps need to be, not only to address the destruction that's happening out in the community, but as well long-term reforms and transformations that really need to happen around how we are addressing public safety in our city.
And who's responsible for that destruction? You've said previously white supremacists and anarchists.
Yes. So President Trump, unfortunately, labeled it as Antifa and other far left folks. What we have seen is that actually evidence of folks who are most active, actually their social media very clearly has them connected to white supremacist groups. And there was a build the wall motif that was put up. So pinning this on far left is just completely ridiculous when the behaviors and even the visuals are very clearly far right.
Philippe Cunningham, a member of Minneapolis City Council. As we heard earlier, crowds of protesters have again been gathering in American cities. New York is just one of the places to which the protests have spread. This was the scene in Harlem on Saturday. I asked our correspondent Peter Bowes, who's in Los Angeles, about the situation across the US.
There are very similar scenes to the kind of scenes we've just been hearing about in New York. Here in Los Angeles, a large crowd has been involved in a standoff with the police in an area of Los Angeles right on the edge of Hollywood, known as the Fairfax District. A number of rubber bullets were fired at the crowd. There is quite a tense standoff situation there right now. And this is quite a well-to-do part of Los Angeles, a partially residential area, partially commercial area. And we're seeing scenes like this around the country. In Chicago, police vehicles have come under attack from some of the protesters and people demonstrating there. They've been vandalized. And again, a similar kind of standoff situation. Very similar, eerily similar, some people might say, considering what we saw about 24 hours ago and the events leading up to the terrible violence that happened throughout the night.
Now, President Trump has suggested that there are radical left agitators. Others have suggested that far right groups are involving themselves. It's a really tense situation, isn't it?
It's very tense, and we're getting very mixed messages from political leaders. And you're right, President Trump has focused on a group known as Antifa. This is an anti-fascist umbrella organization. He's blamed radical left-wing groups for essentially inciting some of this violence. But we've heard on the other side claims that right-wing groups may well be involved in coming into areas, individuals that don't live in certain towns and cities, with the sole purpose of agitating the city and propelling the violence beyond a point that it was already at. In other words, creating more trouble.
Peter Bowes in Los Angeles. Now to launch pad 39A at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff of the Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon. Go NASA, go SpaceX, Godspeed, bottom dog.
The SpaceX Falcon, the first entirely commercially built rocket to carry astronauts into space, lifted off on Saturday. It set off on schedule for a 19-hour journey to the International Space Station after an initial attempt on Wednesday was called off because of bad weather. It's the first mission from American soil to carry crew members into space for nearly a decade. I asked our correspondent Jane O'Brien, who's at the launch site in Florida, whether it was as tense as last time.
This one was just as nail-biting, and the weather again was the star performer, but this time in a good way, because although it was 70% chance of thunderstorms throughout the day, at the moment of truth, the clouds broke, the skies lifted, and there it was. We got liftoff, finally. But it really was nail-biting, because you can't call this until really the very, very last second. So right up until the moment that rocket, that tremendous sound of the engines, the vibration, the explosion, the great flash in the sky, until that very moment, nobody really knew that it was going to happen.
And obviously all space travel is exciting, but what makes this so important?
This is the first commercial space flight, human space flight. And not only that, it's also the first time that Americans have taken off from American soil on an American-made rocket also in almost a decade, because NASA retired its shuttle program in 2011. Since then, Russia has been responsible for transporting astronauts to the International Space Station. That has now changed. Now SpaceX is going to be able to start those missions itself. The first one, in fact, is due to leave on August the 30th with a Japanese astronaut on board. It will now take over that responsibility, and in doing so, will cut the cost, which means that NASA will be able to put more resources into really exciting stuff like getting people back on the moon and then onto Mars.
Now, bits of this rocket are reusable, aren't they?
They are indeed, and they've already recovered the Falcon 9 rocket itself, which landed on a drone ship somewhere in the ocean, a SpaceX drone ship, and can now be reused. And that's all part of the cost saving plan, is that these things don't just blow up and disappear once they've taken off. They can be retrieved and they can be reused, as can the Dragon capsule itself. It will come back to Earth after they leave the International Space Station. It will splash land somewhere about 30 miles off the coast of Florida, and they'll be able to reuse that as well. So it's all about sustainability as well as cost effectiveness.
Our very own possible SpaceX passenger in the future, Jane O'Brien, in Florida. The number of recorded coronavirus cases around the world has just passed 6 million. The latest milestone was announced by Johns Hopkins University in the United States. Steve Jackson reports.
The 6 million figure is for officially confirmed coronavirus infections, as reported by governments around the world. In reality, the number of cases is thought to be very substantially higher, with many people suffering no symptoms and limited testing in a lot of countries. Nonetheless, these figures give at least some indication of the trajectory of the disease. The US still tops the list for both infections and deaths, but the number of new cases continues to fall. The same is true for some of the other worst affected countries, Britain, Spain and Italy. In Brazil, though, the outbreak still appears to be getting worse, and the number of new cases in Russia remains stubbornly high.
That was Steve Jackson. Even before the pandemic, Argentina's economy was struggling, and now, with coronavirus, the country is in an even more precarious state. It has just defaulted for the ninth time in its history and has until Monday to come up with a plan to restructure $65 billion of foreign debt. Our South America correspondent Katie Watson reports.
Sergio Sanchez knows all too well the ups and downs of Argentina's economy. He lost his job nearly 20 years ago after the country's biggest ever default. Now he collects litter on the streets of Buenos Aires. But in difficult times, people come together, he says. Today he's dressed in a visor, carrying a clipboard and overseeing a soup kitchen he runs three times a week. It started off serving 600 people a day. But these past few months, it's risen to as many as 6,000. Coronavirus doesn't care if you're bad or good, rich or poor, says Sergio. Nothing, not even bad governments, can compare to this pandemic. In the queue, students, the unemployed, and desperate families. One woman's come along with her baby boy in the pram. She's come to get nappies and food, With no job and no way to pay rent, she says, she also fears she'll be kicked out of her house. Argentina locked down early, and that's helped the country curb the spread of the virus better than its neighbours. But it's come at huge cost for a country that's been struggling for several years. And all the while, Argentina's fighting another battle, trying to restructure debt owed to foreign investors that it says it can't pay back. But default for many in Argentina means nothing. This is an economy already in crisis. Constanza Guillén is an activist.
I think it's a ghost that's been walking around our country for so many years now that I don't even think we're afraid of it. The problem that we have, or that I see with the default, is it's not a matter of going into default or not going into default. The problem is, how do we get out of this?
Economists around the world have called on creditors to be kind to Argentina in these difficult times. Nobel Prize winner Professor Joseph Stiglitz believes creditors will need to adjust to a new reality.
You can't ask people to die to pay creditors. I mean, it's put in a very bold terms, that's where you draw the line, as any government. If in the midst of this crisis, the pandemic, there's no humanity shown and no reason, people are going to turn, I think, against market economies more generally.
In the trendy suburb of Palermo, Florencia and her husband Gonzalo are doing everything they can to keep their restaurant, Santa Evita, running. In the middle of the dining room is a mural of Argentina's biggest icon, Eva Perón. What would she think about how far the country's fallen? Triumph over adversity was Evita's message. They've had to turn their restaurant into a delivery service. They're making just 20% of what they normally do. Gonzalo is nervous.
I believe it's like a wartime this time, and we have to take every precaution possible, because if one of our people get ill, we have to close again. If we have to close again, we will can't survive.
For now, though, they carry on. Economic crises aren't new here. Default is an old enemy. But the pandemic changes everything.
That was Katie Watson. Still to come, the great peacock giveaway in Tanzania. The Indian government has announced further plans to relax restrictions imposed during the coronavirus lockdown. The move comes as India's daily total of new cases hit another high, as we heard earlier in this podcast, reaching nearly 8,000 new infections. Our correspondent in Delhi, Divya Arya, told us more about the plans.
It's worth bearing in mind that areas which have reported a high number of cases, which are being called containment zones here, still have to observe all restrictions on movement. The entire country also has to observe an all-night curfew, which begins at 9 p.m. and ends at 5 a.m. But most areas will now see a relaxation. Places of religious worship, hotels, restaurants, and even shopping malls will open within a week. However, opening of schools, there's no decision yet, nor is there a decision on the opening of international air travel. But there is an advice that as much as possible work from home, but if you need to go, you can go. So there are no restrictions in terms of 33% of employees can go, or any restriction in the number of hours any offices can open. So many people seeing this as a huge relief.
Now, India's daily total of new coronavirus cases has just hit another high. So are there concerns that perhaps the lifting of some of these restrictions might be a bit too quick?
In fact, it has been very confusing for people that as we have seen a rise in cases, and this rise has been taking place over the last 2 weeks, the same period in which India started removing some restrictions, most importantly on travel between states. So trains and domestic air flights have been resumed over the last 2 weeks. Millions of people have been moved via trains because some of the services were specially restarted to take migrant workers who felt stranded in big cities where they were out of work, back to their hometowns and villages. Now, as they have been moved and tested when they arrive at their destinations, a lot of them have tested positive. India has also increased its testing, though it is still below global levels. So it is very confusing for people, and there is a fair amount of anxiety about the country opening up as cases continue to rise at a faster rate.
That was Divya Arya in Delhi. The British government's defended its decision to relax coronavirus restrictions despite criticism from some of its own advisers, who are members of the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE for short. As our health and science correspondent James Gallagher reports, glaring divisions have emerged on the best approach.
This is a significant moment. Throughout the pandemic, the scientists and politicians have been following the same script. Now there is a clear, loud and public split between some of those advising government and those following the science. They may not be household names, but those speaking out are big figures in their fields and sit on SAGE for a reason. On Thursday, Boris Johnson confirmed the relaxing of lockdown. At the same televised briefing, the PM's chief science advisor, Sir Patrick Vallance, warned there was not a lot of room for manoeuvre and the data urges caution. This is largely a disagreement about when to start lifting lockdown rather than how. If you go early, then we all get a bit of our lives back sooner, but it means we stay close to 8,000 cases a day and have less time to prevent the NHS being overwhelmed if a second wave comes. If you wait longer, then cases are much lower and the virus easier to control. The price is keeping lockdown and all the pain it is causing.
That was James Gallagher. While the efforts of authorities across the world have focused on saving human lives, the welfare of animals during the pandemic has tended to be overlooked. Zoos, for example, have had to carry on feeding their animals and paying their staff without any money coming in from visitors. Our correspondent Kevin Connolly reports from the Paradiso Zoo Park near the Belgian border with France, as it welcomed its first visitors for many weeks.
These rather leery-looking guard dogs may not be the most exotic animals in the Paradiso Zoo, but in lockdown, they have been among the most important. With the rolling hectares of parkland shuttered and deserted, there was a danger that poachers might attack. A single rhinoceros horn can sell for $300,000. The dogs did their job, and now their more exotic fellow creatures are emerging safely from lockdown. It doesn't take much imagination to sense a certain excitement in the air. If you didn't know better, you'd swear the elephants held a sort of morning meeting, starting in an amazingly disciplined straight line and then dissolving into a chaotic huddle.
They're just excitable. You know, we come in and go to say hello.
Their manager, Rob Connicky, whose work is a labour of love, says the elephants have missed the crowds.
They're up in their paddocks day in, day out, and especially Marla, because Marla is our main elephant that we use to introduce to the public, and she gets a lot of carrots. So she gets a lot of carrots and a lot of interaction with people when the people were here. So I think Marla's noticed that she's not getting as much carrots as she was before, you know. But
best of the zoekers.
Belgium's lockdown, like others in Europe, is being unwound only very slowly. The Paradiso Park is allowed to operate at about 20% capacity. That's 5,000 socially distanced, mask-wearing customers following one-way pedestrian paths between the animal enclosures. Still, the visitors assured me, a joy to be unconfined.
And it's really nice to have this surprise that we can come here, okay, with social distance and everything, but yeah. Here, I have been looking for the baby panda since quite some months ago.
Yeah, the baby panda is going to be a big panda now. It's been long lockdown.
I know, that's why we are here. The first day that we can come.
The Paradiso Park takes its name from the ancient Persian concept of paradise, which suggested a walled-off and harmonious garden of peace. But Belgium's lockdown has been tough on this place of tranquility. Even when zoos have no income, they have to feed the animals and pay the keepers to care for them. Mathieu Godefroy of Paradiso says as restrictions ease and visitors return, the park can at least begin to count the cost.
For the whole year of 2020, we're hoping to limit our losses to 30 million euros, which would be our best case scenario.
What's the worst case?
The worst case, we didn't calculate.
Back at the elephant enclosure, as the visitors return, the herd appears determined to put on a bit of a show. Things are not back to normal behind the gates of paradise, but they're getting there.
And that report was by Kevin Connolly. Now, wildlife in Tanzania. The cry of that most beautiful of birds, the peacock. And at a ceremony, the country's president, John Magufuli, gave 100 of them to former heads of state. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told us more.
The lucky recipients of the peacocks are three former presidents of Tanzania, plus the widow of the country's first president, Julius Nyerere. They received 25 peacocks each, we understand, at this ceremony in the capital, Dodoma. And they were also given their share of 100 kilograms of bird feed. So the president obviously keen that they were going to be well looked after.
So the big question is why?
Well, officially, the president of Tanzania, John Magufuli, is saying this is a thank you present to the former heads of state for looking after the peacocks that were at State House when they lived at State House. We understand the number of peacocks has gone up quite markedly. The event that was going on at the time of this giveaway, the great peacock giveaway, was the launch of a new building of a State House in Dodoma. Quite curious that this event is going on when obviously elsewhere in the region and across the world, people are focusing on what might be considered more urgent matters to do with health.
Indeed. And there has been peacock diplomacy before, hasn't there? And did that work?
Yeah, interestingly, last year, in the middle of what was seen as a pretty low point in relations between Tanzania and its northern neighbour, Kenya, the Tanzanian president again turned to his peacocks and he sent four of them to President Uhuru Kenyatta. But I think it would be fair to say that the peacock diplomacy has not really worked because relations are still pretty tense, or at least not as good as they could be. But that's largely because of great differences in how the two countries have approached the coronavirus, nothing to do with how the animals have been looked after.
That was Will Ross. Microsoft has decided to replace dozens of journalists with robots. At the moment, a team of humans select the headlines and stories that appear on the home pages of Microsoft's website and browser. But from July, to cut costs, artificial intelligence software will be choosing, editing and curating the content. This is part of a global shift towards automated news. Julian Marshall spoke to Jane Singer, Professor of Journalism Innovation at City University, London. And he asked her, was he right to think that AI was already creeping into the profession?
It's pretty extensive, probably more so than most people realize. News organizations have been using it for a while and are using it increasingly for a variety of functions, news gathering, curation, distribution, personalization, lots of different things.
And would readers be able to tell the difference?
I think the perception is that when people think about AI journalism, they think about stories that were written by a robot. There is some of that, and you see some sort of traditional, standard sorts of sports stories or financial stories. BBC actually used AI extensively on election night this past time around in December of 2019 to create a lot of local stories. So those kind of stories are generated by AI or primarily generated by AI and then looked at or added to by journalists. But really AI, most of it is being used in ways that are more behind the scenes that you wouldn't necessarily see. So looking through large databases and surfacing ideas or surfacing patterns in the data for journalists to then pick up and make stories from, delivering content to you. So what you see on in your feeds, on a homepage, wherever it is you might be getting news, is tailored to you based on your past experience. So it's used in lots of different ways that actually no people probably wouldn't necessarily notice.
And are these trends addressed now in schools of journalism?
Well, we certainly do talk about AI. We talk about trends. We offer several classes in data journalism now and how to take data sets and find stories in them. So yes, we're there.
Jane Singer, Professor of Journalism Innovation at City University in London. Now, among the many outbursts of emotion caused by George Floyd's death in Minneapolis, one in particular has cut through. This song by a 12-year-old soul singer, Kedron Bryant. I just wanna leave. In the song, written by his mother, Kedron sings of young black men being hunted as prey. It's been widely praised, including by former President Barack Obama. It's already racked up more than 2 million views on Instagram in just a few days. And we're going to end this edition of the Global News podcast with it. I'm a young black man. So that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.